moments of work in this intensive seminar that we are finalizing now with the final conference of Professor Steve Fuller, which is an honor to introduce. Professor Fuller is born in New York City, graduated at the Columbia University in History and Sociology. And then he later studied in Cambridge and Pittsburgh, also both in History and Philosophy of Science. And then since 2011, he holds the Auguste Comte Chair in Social Epistemology in the Department of Epistemology, at the university where he's coming from. And when I was asked to introduce him, and I read the Auguste Comte Chair, I reread again, no? To be sure that we had invited the right person.
You still might have doubts afterwards.
But yes, it was correct. I checked with the organization, and he was the right person, no, to finish this seminar. I can say also that he's a founder of a journal, a quarterly journal of social epistemology, published by Taylor and Francis. And he has many books, and just went to cite the one of the last ones, which is called Humanity 2.0, which is, I think, an interesting topic. And he's also a fellow at the UK Academy of Social Sciences and the European Academy of Sciences and Arts, and a senior research fellow at the Breakthrough Institute, which is like an eco-modernist think tank, and also affiliated scholar at the Institute for Ethics and Emerging Technologies, which is another think tank working or studying on transhumanism. So I think there are interesting topics that he's going to talk about. We asked him to give a final speech or final talk on the topic of managing medium and message in a post-truth world. So since we don't have much time, I would just cede the microphone to him. Thank you very much.
Thank you. First of all, let me thank the organizers for this conference for inviting me and having the honor of meeting the Pope yesterday and all of that stuff. And I want to say a little bit about who I am at the outset, because a little bit of it came through, but maybe you need to hear a little bit more. I'm actually a product of Jesuit education. Okay. And in fact, I went to what I think is the best Jesuit school in the United States, Regis High School in New York City. I was, in fact, number one in my class in 1 year, and I left early to go to Columbia University at the period when Columbia started having an active campaign to recruit Catholics. Okay? Even though I do not consider myself a practicing Catholic, nevertheless, I am very much a Christian and very much interested in theology and in religious affairs generally. But to just put my cards on the table, if you were here yesterday at Margaret Somerville's talk, I'm one of those progressives. Okay? And I'm unapologetically progressive, and I think Christianity is progressive. Okay? And that is part of the point that I want to make here today in terms of because I actually feel this is a really interesting situation for me to be in, because I actually think public relations, generally speaking, has been a very positive thing, okay? And it's been very much part of a kind of an accompaniment to increase democratic intelligence. And in a sense, this is kind of what the post-truth condition is about. So I've written all these books that were alluded to in the introduction, but my latest book that's out next month is called Post-Truth, Knowledge as a Power Game, okay? And this is because I don't think the post-truth condition is really something that is just of our time. Of course, it's interesting that we've got this kind of convergence of events like Brexit and Trump's election and so forth, making post-truth word of the year in the Oxford English Dictionary in 2016. But the post-truth condition, in a way, has been bubbling around for a long time. And I think the most positive way you can think about it, and this is what I would suggest to you, is that there are now multiple sources, multiple conditions under which what is true and false is being produced. And so in a way, it is a kind of testimony to pluralism of the sort that you would expect in increased democratization. Okay? I think that's the way to think about it. So in other words, I think it is kind of a mistake, and let me allude to Margaret Somerville yesterday, I don't know if she's in the room, but I think it's a mistake to sort of think that the way, as it were, out of this situation is to go back to some capital T truth. I really don't think that's the way out. Because unless you really are against democracy and you're against the pluralization of people taking control of sources of knowledge and interpreting from them for themselves, you're going to be in a problem here, okay? And so the only way back from post-truth is a kind of authoritarianism. That's my view. And so the thing is, how do you survive, how do you thrive, how do you succeed in a post-truth environment, which is where I think we're going if you believe in democratization? Okay, that's the issue. And public relations does provide a way into this. And here I think it's really important that people in this field, first of all, engage with the history of public relations, with the literature of public relations. And Richard Johns, first keynote speaker here, I don't know if this is going to work properly, but Edward Bernays, he is the founder of public relations. He wrote several books on this topic. They are worth reading now, because they were, most of them were written before public relations got the bad reputation it has now. Okay? And I think the thing here that is really important is that when you're talking about a democratic society where there are many different voices, you know, voicing themselves, and you have no way of really silencing the voices, then you have to think about how you make your voice be heard more strongly. That is really what the name of the game is, really. Okay? And frankly, I think the Catholic Church, to a large extent, has been a bit complacent on this front, especially in comparison with the Protestants. The Protestants punch much more above their weight than the Catholics do. Okay, you think about that. Because you think about how many Catholics there are in the world, and especially in the United States, after all, since the beginning of the 19th century, since the first wave of immigration to the U.S. from Europe, Catholics have been the largest Christian denomination in the United States, and it's only in 1960 that the United States elected a Catholic president, okay? So obviously there's been some bad public relations with regard to Catholicism up to that point. Seriously, people. Okay? There are even a couple of Catholics who signed the Declaration of Independence. So it seems to me the Protestants have been much better about this. And one of the reasons why I think the Protestants have been better, and this relates to something that hasn't been mentioned yet in my introduction, but relates to perhaps why Jack Valero at the Thomas More Center in London invited me about maybe 10 years ago. And that has to do with intelligent design theory, where I was an expert witness for the defense, that is to say the defense of intelligent design theory, in Pennsylvania. One of the things the Protestants have been very good at doing, it seems to me, is kind of marking out very explicitly and very much in the public domain what difference it makes to be a Christian. Okay? And they're not just, I mean, because look, everyone can be moral. Not everyone can be moral. I mean, in principle, everyone can be moral. They're not necessarily moral, of course. But the point is that I think that Christianity cannot really command a monopoly on this issue. Let's put it that way. And in a sense, if what you're about as directors of communication is to sell Christianity, or sell Catholicism, you have to think, what's the value added? What's the difference that's made? Especially in a culture that is already secular, and part of the secularization has been to incorporate a lot of those Christian values. Okay? Because those Christian values have been secularized to a large extent into what we have called the welfare state, which may be in disintegration. But even if you look at Christian democracy in Europe, right? I mean, there is a sense in which that's already kind of accepted. And so the question then is, what's the value added? What is it that Christianity actually gives you to whatever right-minded good people are already thinking? I really do think that's kind of, and I think Protestants, in a sense, understand this issue much better than Catholics do. I think Catholics, to a large extent, are very much kind of accommodationists, right? I mean, and a lot has to do with the history of Christianity, because after all, Christianity began as Catholicism, right? And so there's a sense in which so much of what I think Catholics think they have to do in terms of public relations is sort of maintaining what's already there, because they are the keepers of the legacy. They are the keepers of the tradition, right? And in a sense, Protestants are somehow seen as irresponsible, you know, descendants, right? Like profligate children, something like that. That's my guess. But the point is that this then really restricts you, especially in a time where people take secularism as the default position. Right? Secularism is the default position. So the point is, what's the value added of being a Christian if people already believe, you know, in the good stuff? And there are already enough people out there objecting to when the poor, you know, are being, you know, not being treated properly and so forth. That's already part of secular culture. Right? A large part. Not necessarily the part that's dominant now, but it's already there. Right? And in that respect, Christianity is just adding an additional voice. But where does Christianity make a difference? And this has something to do with God. Sorry. Okay? God makes a difference. Okay? And I don't hear a lot of talk about God. You know, and I don't, and I'm no evangelical Protestant or anything like this, but Protestants, man, oh man, they are into God, right? And it's not a trivial point. It's not a trivial point. Because the thing that's really important about God, at least in terms of the way I want to frame this argument, in terms of how you have to think about things, comes back to how I'm attached to intelligent design theory in the United States. And this whole idea of thinking there's an alternative way of explaining the nature of life that doesn't rely exclusively on neo-Darwinian forms of evolution. And it goes back to the idea that human beings are created in the image and likeness of God. And insofar as we are able to do science, it is because of our God-like minds. Okay? And that point, should never be out of the equation, right? So in a sense, and this I think is something about the, you know, if you look at the history of science as it's developed in the West, this has been a very important point, namely that what has driven people to actually look deeper and deeper into the nature of reality, beyond whatever is necessary to survive in ordinary material contexts, has been because, in some sense, people have thought in the West, Christians, that there is some that the intelligence behind it is kind of like their own intelligence, and they can fathom it. Okay? Now that has very often led to heresy, and in fact, it's one of the things that led to modernity and secularism. Okay? So what I'm telling you is the story that has actually led to a lot of the things most of you people in the audience are against. But the point is, it's the same story that comes out of Christianity. It is the story that comes out of Christianity. And that's what's interesting, right? It's the idea that when people really took seriously the idea they were created in the image and likeness of God, they believed that they could inquire into things. Now, I would say that the person that you really need to think about as your benchmark on all these matters is St. Augustine, not Thomas Aquinas. I know this is going to be controversial in this audience, but I'm being deliberate here, okay? St. Augustine, and the Franciscans, not the Dominicans. Okay? I mean, for those of you who know stuff, this means something, okay? All right. Good. Because the idea here... No, because I think that the public relations challenge for Catholics in particular, because in a sense the Protestants don't have a lot of the institutional baggage and all the stuff that the Catholics have, but the Catholics, insofar as they want to retain this kind of mantle as being the guardians of Christianity, right, have to, in a sense, just like the Protestants did 500 years ago, go back to the roots and reassert the roots in new form. Right? There is a sense in which there is a need for a reformation. And in a sense, you know, when one thinks about Martin Luther and Calvin and all those guys from 500 years ago, one of the things that's very interesting about those guys is they changed the style of Christianity. They changed the way of speaking, right? Whatever else these guys were doing at a doctrinal level, they were doing something at a PR level. The way they were practicing the faith, right? So it was very common to practice it outdoors, not in churches, right? So that the church as a building didn't matter so much anymore. It wasn't like a cineplex the way Catholic churches are, right? But rather, there was a breaking down of the distinction, right, between the church and what was outside. Protestants were really good at that, and they were good at that 500 years ago, okay? I think the Catholic, and I know the Catholic Church actually, as someone who was brought up that way, that was part of what Vatican II was about, because that's when I grew up as a Catholic. Very liberal period, very progressive period, okay, where Catholicism, in a way, was breaking down boundaries and things like that. And I understand, of course, that over the last 50 years, there has been a lot of moves to continue that, but some moves that have not been continuing that. And I'm telling you now that, in a sense, continuing that is a good idea, okay? And there's a sense in which, the value of thinking about religion, especially Christianity, as a kind of field of public relations, is that it makes you realize that there is a kind of marketplace out there and that there are competitors, right? I really think there is no value in starting with, you know, ethics says this, Margaret Somerville style. I think that's rubbish. I think that's total rubbish, regardless of whether you believe it. It's rubbish. You have to talk about what is the value added in a competitive marketplace where the competitors aren't just secular, but they're other people who call themselves Christian. What difference does Catholicism make? Now, Catholicism already comes in with a lot of advantages, which it's not playing to its favor. Okay? And I really do think this is the way you need to think about matters in the future. And I do think this is one reason why I think that the reluctance of the Catholic Church to get involved in the so-called science and religion controversies, you know, at least with not the gusto that the Protestants have gotten into it, is pretty amazing. Because look, as someone who is trained in the history and philosophy of science, one thing that I can tell you for sure is that that science has been influenced by very many things, and primary above them all has been the Judeo-Christian tradition. That is what has led people to search for knowledge as far as they've had. And one way to think about this is that even Darwin's biggest defender, Thomas Henry Huxley, you may know him, Darwin's bulldog in the UK, toward the end of his life, he gave a very famous lecture, the Romaines Lecture, on evolution and ethics was the title. And he said the big problem in the 20th century would be motivating to continue to do science once people realize what Darwin said was true, and we're just one animal among many animals. Why then try to understand everything? Why try to have a cosmic grasp on everything? Why? Why does that even matter? Whether we're talking about theology or science, why do it? What we should be doing is just doing stuff to survive. That was what Thomas Henry Huxley was saying in 1893, okay? So I think one of the things you want to say about Huxley is that he realized that whatever we want to call, that there was a Darwin of the gaps, right? There is a God place missing, namely motivating science, motivating inquiry. Now, when we move into that terrain, how much more time do I have? 5 minutes, okay, I understand, I'm being serious here. That when we move into this terrain, the options are not just, you know, because Margaret Somerville yesterday was saying, well, you know, people are developing all these new sciences and technologies, but that doesn't mean we can't use it. Well, I mean, those aren't the only two, you know, it's not like you don't either don't use it, right, or don't develop it. You might think intelligently what the point of this stuff is that we are developing, right? And this is where I want to say a positive word about regulation, okay? Because regulation is kind of a bad word here, you know, as if regulation is some kind of weak thing. But the point is, look, I really do think that the human condition, because we are fallen beings, and I take that very seriously, okay? So I take original, and this is where I'm an Augustinian. I take original sin and all that stuff seriously. And so there's a sense in which we are fallen beings, but we have the capacity to rise above that. And one of the very important tools for us to rise above that is science and technology. And because we're fallen beings, we're going to make mistakes. And then the issue becomes, if we can anticipate the mistakes, can we, as it were, adapt to the mistakes once they've happened, right? I mean, there are those questions that arise. So those are questions of regulation. But the point is, insofar as we are going to try to recover, right, our God, you know, our God-given heritage as creatures created in the image and likeness of God, then science and technology are part of it. And so the issue of regulation is very much what the discussion should be about, right? And there are a lot of ways to play that, a lot of ways to play that. And this is where public relations, especially public relations in tune with theology, and I want to stress that point too, because so much of my understanding of what public relations is about has a lot to do with my understanding of theology, right? And because theology actually offers an enormous amount of resource in terms of thinking in a very sophisticated, nuanced way about what it means to believe in God, what it means to act in the God-like fashion, and so forth. Okay? And the problem is, I think, that so often public relations is a little bit too responsive to religious believers on the ground, to religious practices, you know, in a sense serving that market, whereas in fact it should be serving a universal market. And there, I think the theologians are speaking much more effectively. However, they speak more effectively, but in a coded kind of way. And this is where public relations can actually be very useful as a way, in a sense, of popularizing, right, or, you know, some of these very subtle distinctions that, nevertheless, if they were made clear, would be very relevant to ordinary people. So don't be afraid of theology. Really, okay? But in any case, I actually see a very progressive future for the Catholic Church because coming from the history and philosophy of science, which is normally where I'm talking about stuff, the future of science is very open, right? And public relations flourishes in an open field. And I think one problem that you people have is you think that the options for you are more closed than they really are. There's really a lot more to play for here. You could play with uncertainty. Uncertainty is not your enemy. Really, it is not your enemy. Sorry, Margaret Somerville, right? Right, uncertainty is your friend. And there, and if you learn something about the history of science, if you know, if your knowledge of the history of science was as good as your knowledge of the history of Christianity, you'd realize this immediately. Okay? And the only reason why you don't realize it is because the scientists have better PR than you do. I'll stop there.
Person to finish.
That was an attack.
Sorry.
I'm a Thomist.
Sorry. Sorry.
That's the nicest thing I've ever.
Sorry. No. Okay. Yeah.
That was part of the last spectacle. But I think that this talk gave a lot to think. Of course, we don't have time now for questions. But I just got a few sentences that I think can be a good heritage for us. And the first one is that we have this PR challenge, right? And we can see that, of course, from many perspectives. But we have to sell Christianity in some way, and there is a new style that we need to improve in our communication. And in that sense, we have to show very clearly what different Christianism, faith, Catholicism makes. I think this is an interesting point that we can bring with us. And for that reason, our communications work, our PR work in some sense, should be in tandem with theology. And this idea of putting the faith behind our work, and the passion at the same time behind our work. So don't be afraid of theology.
Yes.
And I just want to thank Steve for this interesting and complete talk. Of course, I want to thank the Chancellor of the University that I did at the beginning. I'm sorry very much. I was very excited. And now the closing words from him and presentation of the President of the Senate. Thank you very much.
Il saluto finale, come avete visto, abbiamo l'onore di avere con noi il nostro grande cancelliere, non sono Fernando Caris, privato lo problema, già professore di teologia a questa università, quindi ringrazio personalmente e anch'io emozionalmente, anche se poi dovrò fare qualche altro ringraziamento, però adesso per ora arriva.
Allora, siamo ormai alla conclusione di questo seminario che ogni due anni venisse qui all'Università della Santa Croce, tanti professionisti che svolgono attività di comunicazione nella Chiesa. Desidero innanzitutto, comunque in qualche caso l'italiano lo spagnolo lo intendete bene. Desidero innanzitutto ringraziarvi per il vostro lavoro e incoraggiarvi a continuare a svolgere generosamente questo servizio alla Chiesa e alla società civile. Riguardo ai tre concetti principali indicati nel titolo di questa edizione, dialogo, rispetto e libertà di espressione, vorrei evidenziare due idee che si trovano nel testo di Papa Francesco utilizzato nella presentazione del seminario. Diceva il Papa, abbiamo bisogno di comporre le differenze attraverso forme di dialogo che ci permettano di crescere nella comprensione e nel rispetto. La cultura dell'incontro richiede che siamo disposti non soltanto a dare, ma anche a ricevere dagli altri. In primo luogo, che significa crescere nella comprensione e nel rispetto nel campo della comunicazione pubblica? Forse consiste prima di tutto nel rendersi conto che ogni comunicazione coinvolge persone, con nome e cognome, coloro che comunicano, le persone sulle quali si comunica, e infine le persone alle quali la comunicazione è indirizzata. La comprensione inizia quando cerchiamo di vedere persone concrete e non masse al centro di ogni relazione comunicativa, anche se queste persone non sono fisicamente presenti. Non le vediamo, ma ci sono, con tutta la loro dignità, soprattutto quando sono più vulnerabili. Ogni persona è importante, perché Gesù Cristo è morto ed è risorto per tutti e per ognuno. Specialmente negli ultimi anni, in cui sono apparse numerose notizie false, le parole comprensione e rispetto significano rinnovare la professione dell'informazione dall'interno, approfondire la dimensione di servizio a ogni donna e a ogni uomo, perché una persona ben informata è una persona più libera e responsabile e quindi più capace di agire nella società in maniera solidale. D'altra parte, coloro che rispettano gli altri, la realtà delle cose e l'essenza della professione, diventano più rispettabili, migliori interlocutori nei dibattiti pubblici. Cercando di capire gli altri, di comprendere i loro punti di vista, si scoprono aspetti concreti che non erano stati presi in considerazione. Si perfezionano le proposte e, in definitiva, ci si rende più comprensibili. Se invece il lavoro di comunicazione ignora le domande o le perplessità dell'altro, il monologo sostituisce il dialogo. In secondo luogo, in questo gioco di dare e ricevere a cui il Papa si riferisce, è importante riscoprire che, come comunicatori della Chiesa, avete l'opportunità, propria della vostra libertà religiosa, di proporre nella società la forza della verità stessa, presente nella fede cristiana. La possibilità di illuminare le strutture umane con lo spirito del Vangelo fa parte del diritto fondamentale alla libertà religiosa. Le donne e gli uomini di oggi sono ancora affamati di verità, e continuano a cercare il senso profondo della loro vita. Con il vostro lavoro e la vostra amicizia potete essere gli artefici dello splendido compito di aiutarvi a vicenda nella ricerca della verità. La dignità umana richiede la tutela della capacità di autodeterminazione personale verso la verità, senza privazioni né coercizioni. Per questo motivo, il fondamento del diritto alla libertà religiosa, così come inteso dal Magistero della Chiesa, è il medesimo degli altri diritti civili, di stampa, di opinioni, eccetera. E questo fondamento non è altro che la dignità umana. Consentitemi, infine, una riflessione legata alla velocità che a volte condiziona i compiti di comunicazione, all'immediatezza con cui siete costretti ad agire e a prendere decisioni importanti. La necessità che tutti noi abbiamo di coltivare grandi spazi interiori di serenità per rendere fruttuoso il nostro lavoro. La serenità ci permette di dare profondità al nostro lavoro, di scoprirne la dimensione di eternità e riposare in Dio. San José María, al cui spirito è dovuta la creazione di questa università, dà un suggerimento concreto per la nostra vita quotidiana. Dice: cerca riposo nella filiazione divina. Dio è un padre pieno di tenerezza, di infinito amore. Chiamalo Padre molte volte al giorno e digli da solo nel tuo cuore che lo ami, che lo adori, che senti l'orgoglio che ti riempie di forza di essere suo figlio. Il senso e la forza del saperci figli di Dio, che sono ancora più presenti in questi giorni di Pasqua, ci porteranno a vivere la serenità nel nostro lavoro, a trasmettere pace e speranza nelle nostre relazioni, a unire fede e professionalità. Un comunicatore sereno potrà infondere un senso cristiano nel flusso inevitabilmente veloce dell'opinione.